From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Chirino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast.
I'm going to say what I've been drinking first.
Please go.
Okay. We released our Pinot Noir list this week, and I had a lot of those wines, luckily, and some really good ones. Obviously, the Hirsch.
Yeah.
Very good. Had the Johann Vineyards Sapiens, I think is how, maybe how you say it, and the Reeve Mirama. I had never had Reeve before.
Reeve's great.
Yeah. So those were some of the standouts for me this past week.
Very cool.
Thanks.
Zach, what about you? That was quick, too, Jared. I was like, boom.
Yeah.
I'm done.
We've got business to attend to here.
Yeah.
So I actually revisited an old favorite that I hadn't had in a long time. So Russian River Brewing, which had been, you know, is obviously famous, mostly for Pliny the Elder, but for lots of other beers, too, had not been distributed in Washington for years, and then came back into the state about a year ago. And I had sort of been like, oh, you know, I should probably check one of those things out. And then I happened to be, there's like a little kind of a beer store near my house, and I was like poking in there for looking around at kind of what they had. I was kind of trying to get a sense for some of like what they were putting out for their seasonals, just to kind of have a sense of what's out in the market. And like, they had some bottles of Damnation from Russian River, and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna pick this up. I haven't drank this beer probably in a decade. And I got home, it was a sunny afternoon, opened it, and I was like, this is fucking good beer. So yeah, that was really, really tasty. And a nice, like, it's fun to, for me sometimes, to revisit some of those beers that were, you know, really, in some ways, really important and instrumental in kind of shaping my beer palate a long time ago, that I just, for a variety of reasons, don't revisit as often, in Russian River's case in particular, because it was hard to get here. But yeah, that was kind of a fun one. How about you, Adam?
Cool. So this past week, I got to go to 11 Madison Park and finally try the martini that made it to the finals, Leek, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And then also, Sebastian made me the Bedford and Grand, his modern classic that he created. That's
a Manhattan
riff, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That is also really, really awesome.
And he recently did the episode on the Manhattan with Tim. Cocktail College, yeah.
So that was a really cool experience. And they were out with the Manhattan cart, and mm-hmm. they have a whole Manhattan menu. And it's a lot of fun, and the bar there is great.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably the highlight for me this week. Otherwise, I'm just getting ready for vacation, man. You guys are going to be on your own these next few episodes while I chill out.
Yes.
You're going to tell the people where you're going, or are they going to have to wait until you get
back
to
here? They can wait. They can wait. They don't need to know. They can wait.
You'll have some tropical drinks.
Exactly. And then I'll talk
and
about all those.
Some French wine, maybe.
Maybe some French wine.
Mm-hmm.
So now guess where I might be going.
Oh, wait. But Adam's actually bringing rum.
Yeah, I don't know why. I know my dad was like, "You want to bring some rum? Can you bring some rum?" I'm like, "Cool, I'll bring some rum." But yeah, it should be fun. Although the place I'm going, they do not make rum.
Oh,
okay.
Okay. So
this one location. Other
so
places
it's not
around
bringing
them,
cold
them
rum. Yeah,
it's not like
gotcha.
You couldn't get rum.
No,
but
you can get rum, just not made there.
Right.
Okay, so we're getting ready for May here at VinePair, and part of getting ready for May is obviously, in May, we come out with our best tequilas of the year list.
Well, next week, really. This week.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
In preparation for May.
And one of the things that we've noticed, and that was first pointed out by Tim,
mm-hmm.
Who manages the process for all the spirits tastings, is that this is the first year that we have gotten a massive amount of Blanco tequilas. So often from brands that we have not received before, or from new brands, or new SKUs from established brands, where the price points are well over $100, some reaching up to $170 a bottle. And the question that we've kind of been having internally is like, who are these Blanco tequilas for? Because traditionally, at least as a consumer, right, we're taught that Blanco is either, some people sip them, and there are some definitely sippable Blancos, especially some of them that are, you know, made in a more historical craft process, mm-hmm. Where you really are getting to taste the fresh agave. We've heard from a lot of master distillers that their favorite way to consume tequila is via Blanco. You know, Añejo and Reposado really are much more popular outside of Mexico.
Created for the American market.
Right, created for the American market.
That's kind of
how I understand it. Yep. But Blanco is like sort of the pure version of tequila. But still, most people think of Blanco and they think of either shooting it or they think of mixing it in cocktails.
Entry-level tequila.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And these are very expensive, rivaling now the cost of some Reposados and Añejos. Now, we also have the Reposados and Añejos that are even more expensive, like the 1942s that are a Reposado that is almost $200 a bottle. But still, what is happening here, and who are these Blancos for? Because it kind of seems like, to me, people are trying to take price just to take price and have something that's very expensive. And again, some of the Blancos that are submitted are from artisanal producers who are, you know, probably passing on a lot of that artisanal cost to the consumer. But a lot of the Blancos are made by American entrepreneurs who are going down to Mexico and working with a distillery and buying the liquid and bottling it in very fancy bottles. So are they right? Like, is there a market for this? To me, it seems a little bit crazy.
I mean, the first thing that I want to say is probably that I think a lot of people associate price with quality. And so, especially in tequila, where, you know, maybe more recently the quality of tequila has been called into question. There are additives. Like, maybe some consumers know about that. Maybe some don't. But I think that raising or releasing a Blanco at a higher price point of $70, $85, $90, even $190, maybe $190 is like way too much actually, but might communicate to consumers that this is a quality product, whether or not it is. I think that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said about this idea of tequila producers responding to what had been in sort of surging demand for tequila, premiumization, et cetera, and a little bit being like, well, maybe this Blanco tequila we can actually charge more for than we were planning to or than we have charged in the past.
Yep.
And whether that's just raising prices or launching a new product with slightly different kind of language or packaging that is functionally kind of the same thing but just rebranded and at a higher price point. I do wonder if the biggest challenge that these Blanco tequilas will face is just a kind of widely held, if rarely interrogated, belief that the average drinker has, which is that, like, clear spirits should be relatively inexpensive. And we've talked before about gin and ultra premium gin and whether there's a market for that. And I think that where we have tended to land is even in the realm of this, you know, kind of martini moment that we're in, as we talked about last episode, and how people do want a higher end experience that involves gin in those martinis. Even there, it is a little bit hard to get people on board with $100+ bottles of gin. And now you, me, you know, many of our listeners will understand that tequila is a different kind of clear spirit. Blanco tequila is a somewhat different kind of clear spirit than gin or vodka or rum or things like that. That there are a lot of reasons why, you know, perhaps the sort of highest expression in the eyes of many distillers and many drinkers is Blanco tequila. And that, in a way, because of the realities of agave, the fact that it's not a kind of yearly crop, but is a, you know, takes multiple years for the piñas to mature, and all these things that go into making a tequila a little bit of an anomaly within the clear spirit world, I think a lot of that is lost on most consumers, even consumers who might be inclined to spend a lot of money on spirit. And I just wonder if it's going to be very hard to convince the average drinker who does look at Blanco tequila, as we said, as a shooter or as a mixer, to say, well, how much do I really want to be paying for something that I'm essentially just going to put in a margarita?
Yeah, I mean, I think it becomes very hard to really, I mean, at the end of the day here, I think this becomes very hard to convince the trade. Like, why
well,
is...
Really?
I think, yeah.
Because then they can just charge more for their cocktails, no?
No, because, like, again, because then as who's paying for it, right? So you're going to have to upcharge if you're paying that much for Blanco, right? And that's why there are very well known and highly regarded house tequilas, well tequilas for a reason, because that's what most people are using in their margaritas and their other tequila drinks, that most of the big alcohol companies own. These really, really super premium Blancos, like, are for a very specific audience. And I feel like unless you are a agave focused bar,
okay,
or you're like a nightclub and you've already been told that like there's some sort of signal that you're giving to the market by ordering this. Like, I just don't understand how you convince a beverage operator to bring this on to their program, because it's extremely expensive, and you're then having to hand sell and explain to the consumer why they should pay this. And I just, again, I think everyone, it just feels to me like everyone is on the 1942 train. Like, everyone's trying to catch that and, you know, Clase Azul. Like, how do we catch these? And a little bit, actually, Casa Dragones.
Okay.
Like, how do we catch these three brands that are considered to be super premium, or, at, you know, in Casa Dragones' case, at all the parties in the Hamptons in the summers, you know, in 42's case, big in nightlife and celebrity moments, the Oscars, right? And then sort of Clase Azul, all of the in-between, right? And so everyone's like, well, then maybe I can create the next thing, and people pay for the Blanco, because people are still shooting these reposados that are really expensive. Or in Casa Dragones' case, it is sort of like a high, super premium Blanco. But I just don't think that there's enough space for all these other ones. And I think at the end of the day, this is where we're going to see like the market kind of drop out. Like, and yeah. I think especially when like it's the brands that already have super premium SKUs and like other spaces, these now super premium Blancos, like, it's debatable whether or not they will cannibalize.
You mean tequila SKUs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will they cannibalize the other SKUs of these tequila brands if they're new? And for the new ones, like, what's in that Blanco that makes it so special? And the only way I think that you could articulate that is by going after a real agave head and explaining how it's 100% traditionally made.
Yeah.
Right? If you're sort of like hiding, I mean, the bottle that we got that's $170.
$190.
I think it's like actually from a pretty well-known wine producer. Like, I think he owns a lot of vineyard wineries in California.
Okay.
And like, it never made a tequila before. So this one's like, I don't really get it. And there's no way that he's not buying the liquid from somebody, from some nom, right? And just bottling it and trying to convince you, I guess, through marketing. But again, I've not ever seen a demand for high-end, expensive Blanco tequila.
Do you think that these are more expensive because they're actually, like, from a production point of view, they're more expensive to make?
I think only the artisanal ones. But, like, this one I'm talking about with 190, there's no way that's an artisanal Blanco.
Yeah, the bottle's really interesting.
It's not an artisanal Blanco. It's not possible to be. Like, I just... they're not telling that story. It's all about the design and the name, and there's definitely, I mean, maybe it's additive free. I haven't tested it, so I don't know, but I would be doubtful. So I don't get it. Like, where at least like Fortaleza, like the reason Fortaleza can demand the prices it demands is because consumers who are really into the Fortaleza style tequila, which is, you know, 100% pure, all ancient method production, etc., like they really they really respond to the Fortaleza story. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of these ones that we're getting sent in, like they're not trying to tell that story. They're not really telling any story besides like we're expensive.
Yeah.
I just don't know how well that works in alcohol. Like we're expensive just to be expensive. And it's just interesting that it's all Blancos that are trying to do it right now.
Yeah.
Well, I do think that there's like this just fascinating sort of tug of war within tequila more broadly between sort of the attempting to kind of ape the sort of most popular, very, very high-end bottles, you know, the ones that you mentioned, Adam, by, you know, putting stuff out in distinctive packaging at similar price points and sort of trying to, yeah, claim some of that market share. And then there's the sort of tension between, you know, sort of the Blanco and the more aged expressions and kind of where is agave going? Like where mm-hmm. is the raw material going into? Like which area of this category is more prime for growth? And I think that actually it was interesting to me, I was thinking about this as we were talking, that like Mezcal, interestingly enough, has actually had, I think, better luck putting bottles out there in this price point, because inherent in the discussion of Mezcal is a discussion of wild, in most cases, agave, of individual varieties of agave, of very site-specific production. Yep. All of these things that to a certain kind of drinker are signifiers of quality, or at least of differentiation that is worth paying for. And tequila, I think, really struggles with that. That's not to say that there aren't really great, you know, sort of single site tequilas mm-hmm. out there, but you know, I remember, Adam, years ago we had, I think you interviewed someone from Tequila Ocho,
yeah.
That has always kind of focused on a lot of like their essentially like estate agave fields. And, you know, I think that was a really interesting conversation. I think what they are doing is interesting, but I think that that message is really hard to get through to a consumer. And
well, but also to be fair, Tequila Ocho is also then pricing the Blanco, even doing that at a pretty fair price for the consumer. Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
they're not
yeah.
then turning around and saying, but here's the Blanco from all this from a very specific site for $190.
Right. Which they probably yeah. could.
They could.
Right.
Well, maybe. I mean, I think it depends on how much they want to sell. Right.
Right.
Because I think that and who they're trying to sell it to in a way. But I think that, that but my point is like, I think that's a brand that has really focused on that message. And even then, I would be curious to know to what extent that has really landed with consumers. I think that, you know, we mentioned sort of the, well, is this for bars and for cocktails and stuff? And I think, you know, it's really interesting here to take a moment to talk about why I don't think this is the destination for these kinds of bottles at all. And it's because I think that we, like, I mean, this is going to sound a little bit, that's not derogatory, just a little bit like peeling back the curtain a little too much. But like what a bar would really like to do is find you a tequila that you will enjoy drinking that doesn't cost them very much money. Like
yep.
the bars rarely are going, unless again, as Adam said, they are a very agave focused bar where people are going to come in and are going to get off on trying a $50 1 ounce pour of something because it's just rare or special or whatever. But even in relatively, you know, even if bars with high, you know, high cocktail costs and stuff like that, what they want is to not, you know, they want to charge you for all the stuff that they do. They don't really want to just be taking in a bottle and having to charge you a full markup on the ingredient that they don't make. And so I really do think this is for a kind of conspicuous consumption, or maybe in some cases the kind of person who, you know, just sees it as being like, I'm a kind of person with a lot of money who spends a lot of money on everything.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I spend $130 on a bottle of tequila? Like that's just my base. You know, that's what I spend on my bottle of whatever I'm going to drink. I don't really care if it's quote unquote worth it. That's just my baseline.
I actually think the more we're chatting, I think like what this is proof of, and this is just another symptom, right, of the disease. Because we talked about the other symptoms, right? The fast follows of people sort of copying certain bottle styles, etc. is like, I think the majority of people right now in tequila, including a lot of the big companies, actually have no idea why tequila is popular right now, what's causing it to grow, what people are actually looking for. And everyone's just throwing shit against the wall and copying each other because no one actually really seems to have an idea. Because for the longest time, tequila was a very steady liquid in the U.S. Like, people liked it, especially in certain parts of the country. But, like, you know, there were a few pretty well-known luxury brands people knew. There were people who were tequila drinkers, but most people, if you were a clear spirits drinker, you were a vodka drinker. And, like, then who knows if it was Clooney with his I don't get hangover. Like, no one really knows what that inflection point was, but something caused tequila to sort of start to take off. And then sort of 42 came out of nowhere, and people started paying attention to brands like Fort Delice, and then all of a sudden you have all these agave bar-focused bars, and tequila started to boom. And then it really boomed in COVID. But I don't think anyone really seems to have any concept of, like, what is driving the market and what is going to continue to fuel growth. And it seems like a lot of people are releasing these things hoping that it will continue to fuel their growth,
right,
and growth of the category. And I just, again, don't know if – and this is probably coming from the assumption that a lot of the growth is being driven by the super luxury high-end market of tequila. But we're now actually seeing that what's starting to drive growth even more is that lower-end area of tequila. And I think
not lower end, but it's also just, it's Blanco.
Yeah.
Right.
And I just don't think that people have any concept. And so they're just, it is what it is. The data is not strong enough to prove to people, to prove to anyone what people actually want or what they're willing to pay. And there's a few brands that are still doing well that are really expensive. So people are like, well, fuck it. You know, if if it works at Reposado, maybe it works in Blanco, and then a lot of people are copying each other because all these releases get documented and people are all jumping in. But I think it's just because there's a very large lack of understanding of what is actually driving tequila's growth in the first place.
Yeah, maybe it's like you prefer Blanco from like a flavor point of view, but the brand that you like doesn't have a Blanco that's priced higher, so you go to another brand for something that's like a little bit better quality but still Blanco. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think, you know, to kind of piggyback on what Zach was saying earlier, I think that this country had, like, Americans' introduction to tequila was a very specific thing back in the day. And it's taken a long time for us to kind of evolve past the you know, mixto shooting tequila kind of culture. And margaritas are super prevalent still and very popular. And that's a whole other thing. I think that's boosted the category. I mean, we've explored this in a piece in like exploring tequila's global appeal. Right. And so for outside of the United States, it's still not there yet.
Right.
Right. And so here it's evolved to a certain point. But like you're saying, Adam, like I do think that the health claims are really what spurred the growth of tequila as a spirit.
I think it did too.
I think it's actually really interesting to interrogate these two points at once, because I was going to mention that I think one of the challenges that tequila is currently facing is that it isn't having the same kind of success overseas that it has had in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a way you get this kind of almost like frantic, feels like to me, kind of like looking around like, okay, well, wait a second. We've been like, for a couple years, we thought like tequila to the moon. And now it's like, well, maybe it's actually kind of just like, expanded, but is maybe now reaching another kind of plateau as opposed to growing continually. So now we have all this potentially additional production coming online that may not have a target audience exactly. So we're kind of flailing around. And I'm wondering too, and again, this is going to be total guesswork, so, you know, whatever. I wonder if those specific things that we've pointed to as helping boost tequila's popularity here in the United States, those health claims and things like that, the kind of health halo we've talked about with tequila, do we think they just don't appeal to other markets the same way? Like, do we think that there is something inherent to the interaction between those kinds of health claims and, I don't know, the American psyche that means that something like George Clooney saying tequila doesn't give me hangovers causes a meaningful change in the way a meaningful number of Americans view the spirit and doesn't have the same effect on, you know, people in Europe or Asia or whatever?
Yes. I think that it's more prevalent here. I do. And here's why. Because I think, whatever, go with me on this.
Yeah.
I think it has to do with the legal drinking age. I think that because outside of the United States, it's lower and drinking culture is more ingrained in society, whatever culture of these places, that we have a lot of underage drinking in this country. And it's a lot of like, you know, overdoing it on bad alcohol.
Yep.
And so, yeah, horrible hangovers. So anything that promises, like, you're not going to have that hangover is super appealing.
Yeah, I agree.
And I do think that it's really taken off here more as a result. I don't know. You can disagree with me.
No,
I might be totally wrong.
I think the health connection here is very much,
We're obsessed with health and diet, I think, more than most other countries.
I agree.
I do.
I agree. All the diet fads, all the health fads, all the, like, now I'm only eating this, not that. You know, I agree. We're much more obsessed than the rest of the world. And I think a lot of the rest of the world, like, sticks to what their cultures normally eat, right? And I think probably because we're this melting pot and everyone's coming in from other places, we're okay, well, then how do we create, like, an American diet that's, like, optimized and healthy and all these things? And so I do think, you know, that idea that now tequila is better for you than other spirits is what drives it. And, you know,
that's why vodka's so popular here.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, vodka's very popular in Europe too.
That's true. Yes. But I think, you know, the other thing you hear about with, you know, you think about tequila is around the same time. It's this connection, like the agave plant and the cannabis plant are related and all these things. It's the same reason again, like most people, this is not related to tequila, it's related to wine, but like part of the reason natural wine blew up was not because the consumers that were being sold it by Psalms didn't like the taste, but they were told it was natural and better for them. And if you look at a lot of these companies
on... Or there was an implication that it was better for them.
Yes, if you look at a lot of these companies that are advertising on Instagram and Facebook, et cetera, with these startup wine brands, they're all promoting health and promoting that, like, their wines are clean and pure. I mean, we know Dry Farm is one of the most egregious about it, right? They do it all the time. And, like, they've been called out for it and they've been sued over it, you know? And I think people are looking for a way to have the vice, but feel better about having the vice. And so if you're told, well, this vice is healthier for you than that vice, then you have this vice instead. And so people are being told, oh, the hangovers are better with tequila. And then, yes, and Blanco is probably better because, you know, clear spirits are better than dark spirits for you. And that's it. And so then I think the bet people are making is, well, then will they pay a premium for the clear spirit that's better for them?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'll be curious to see if some brands get more aggressive in pursuing that specific sales pitch, I guess, of like, you know, again, we haven't seen a ton of leaning into additive free from most producers, maybe in part because they're not. But I do think that there is something to be said about trying to create a sort of vibe around healthfulness that you don't ever come out and say, because of course you can't, because in the end it's alcohol and it's not like healthy for you exactly. So it is an interesting kind of knot to untangle. But I agree that brands are very much looking to kind of create that association, even if they don't come out and say it.
Yep. Yeah. What is, just out of curiosity, do you guys know what the most successful Casamigos SKU is? Is it Blanco?
I think it's Blanco, yeah.
Okay.
I would assume so.
I think that's interesting too.
I think it's Blanco. I think that they're number one. I mean, I do think that this new spicy tequila they're releasing probably is going to be pretty successful as well. But
Casamigos.
Yeah, but I think that Blanco is by far their most successful.
Yeah. And that's obviously extremely popular.
Yeah. And it's but again, it's priced well for people.
Yep.
And people like the Casamigos flavor profile, and they like that flavor profile then in cocktails, in margaritas.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, we'll see. Let us know what you think. Hit us up, podcast@vinepair.com. And I hope you guys have a great time without me.
Oh, you know we won't. But have a wonderful vacation. We'll manage.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.